New York. This is Democracy Now!
We are told it's an accident, but I'm going to tell you it is not an accident. Dante Wright was killed before he was even stopped because he's a black man in America.
Protests are continuing in the Minneapolis area after a police officer shot and killed Dante Wright during a traffic stop. Police now claim the white officer accidentally pulled her gun instead of her taser on the 20-year-old African-American man. The shooting took place about 10 miles from where former Minneapolis officer Derek Chauvin is on trial for killing George Floyd. On Monday, Philonis Floyd told jurors his older brother was a mama's boy who was devastated by her death in 2018.
He would just say, "Mama, Mama," over and over again. And I didn't know what to tell him because I was in pain, too. We all were hurting. And he was just kissing her. And just kissing her. He didn't want to leave the casket.
We'll go to Minneapolis to look at the killing of Dante Wright and the trial of Derek Chauvin. Then we'll speak to Ben Jealous, president of People for the American Way, about the right-wing smear attack targeting Kristen Clark, President Biden's pick to become the first black woman to head the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A warning to our audience, our top stories contain graphic footage and descriptions of police violence. In Minnesota, police fired tear gas, rubber-coated bullets, and stun grenades as protesters defied a curfew and took to the streets of the Minneapolis suburb of Brooklyn Center for a second straight night. They were demanding justice for Dante Wright, a 20-year-old black man shot dead by a police officer during a traffic stop Sunday. State authorities have identified the officer who killed Wright as Kimberly Potter, a 26-year police veteran who served as the police union president for the department. She's been placed on administrative leave. On Monday, Brooklyn Center Police Chief Tim Gannon claimed Potter accidentally pulled a gun instead of a taser. He also played an excerpt of body camera footage showing the police shooting. According to the Star Tribune, Dante Wright is the sixth person killed by Brooklyn Center Police since 2012. Five of the six have been men of color. On Monday, the director of the Minnesota chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations joined calls for Officer Kim Potter to face criminal charges. This is Jelani Hussein.
We are told it's an accident, but I'm going to tell you it is not an accident. Dante Wright was killed before he was even stopped because he's a black man in America. Dante Wright was killed by this white officer because she did not see his humanity. She did not believe that black lives mattered.
The police killing of Dante Wright took place just 10 miles from downtown Minneapolis, where former officer Derek Chauvin's on trial for killing George Floyd last May. On Monday, a cardiologist called as an expert witness by the prosecution testified Floyd died due to oxygen deprivation, not from drugs or a heart condition, after Derek Chauvin pressed him into the pavement for over 9 minutes. Another expert witness, law professor and former police officer Seth Stoughton, blasted Chauvin's actions.
No reasonable officer would have believed that that was an appropriate, acceptable, or reasonable use of force.
George Floyd's brother, Philonis, gave tearful testimony as the prosecution wrapped up its case. Derek Chauvin's defense is due to call its first witnesses today. After headlines, we'll go to Minneapolis for the latest on the police killings of Dante Wright and George Floyd. U.S. health officials are calling for an immediate pause in the use of Johnson & Johnson's single-dose COVID-19 vaccine after six recipients developed a rare complication from blood clots within 2 weeks of their vaccinations. One woman died. Another has been hospitalized in critical condition. It's not known if the vaccine caused the disorders. The Centers for Disease Control reports as many as 100,000 people regularly die of blood clots each year, and clotting is often a symptom of COVID-19. On Monday, the U.S. recorded 70,000 new cases as the nation's COVID-19 death toll passed 562,000. The CDC reports 120 million U.S. residents have received at least one dose of a vaccine. The World Health Organization warns global COVID-19 cases are continuing to rise exponentially, with 4.4 million positive tests last week, the seventh straight week of increases. Among the hardest hit nations are India, which reported more than 160,000 new infections Tuesday, and Brazil, where COVID-19 deaths have topped 355,000, second only to the United States. In Russia, government statistics show over 360,000 excess deaths in 2020. The findings strongly suggest Russia sought to cover up the true toll of the pandemic, as it reported just 57,000 deaths from COVID-19 last year. In the Philippines, far-right President Rodrigo Duterte made his first public appearance in nearly 2 weeks Monday, seeking to end speculation about whether he'd fallen ill from a coronavirus infection.
If you want me to die early, you must pray harder.
Duterte said he would waive his chance to get a COVID-19 vaccine, outraging public health officials who've called on him to be vaccinated in public in order to combat vaccine hesitancy. This week, Duterte's administration relaxed sweeping lockdown measures for the capital, Manila, and surrounding regions, despite a record surge in infections that's threatening to overwhelm hospitals. The Philippines is now the worst affected country in Southeast Asia. Just over a Philippines residents have received 10 COVID-19 vaccination, a tiny fraction of the nation's 110 million people. Meanwhile, England has begun reopening pubs, gyms and restaurants after months of lockdown. COVID-19 cases in the UK have plummeted due to one of the world's fastest mass vaccination programs, with some 40 million doses administered. In Brussels, European Union officials are deciding whether to allow emergency use of Russia's Sputnik V vaccine after many European nations suspended use of AstraZeneca's vaccine for younger people amid reports of rare incidents of blood clots. In clinical trials, the two-dose Sputnik V outperformed AstraZeneca with over 90% efficacy at preventing COVID-19. Regeneron Pharmaceuticals has asked the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to expand emergency use of its monoclonal antibody cocktail. Regeneron says a clinical trial showed its drug reduced the risk of symptomatic infection by over 80% among people who lived in the same household as someone who tested positive for coronavirus. In immigration news, human rights defenders are condemning the Biden administration's agreements with Mexico, Honduras, and Guatemala to further militarize their borders in an attempt to keep asylum seekers from reaching the United States. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said Monday the objective is to make people's journey north and crossing through borders more difficult. Erica Guevara Rosas, Amnesty International's America's director, denounced Biden's move and said, quote, "Instead of deploying more troops, governments in the region must respect and uphold people's right to asylum and live in safety." To see our full interview with her, you can go to democracynow.org. The United Nations is warning the entire population of St. Vincent has been left without access to clean water as a volcano continues to spew ash and hot gas over the Caribbean island nation. The UN says about 20,000 evacuees are in need of shelter. Cruise ships dispatched to ferry St. Vincent residents to safety refused to pick up passengers unless they could prove they've been vaccinated against COVID-19, and some neighboring islands said they would only take in vaccinated people. In Japan, government officials have announced plans to release more than 1 million tons of radioactive water from the damaged Fukushima nuclear power station into the ocean. The plans are drawing condemnation from China, South Korea, environmental groups and local fishers who worry the industry will be further impacted. Japanese officials say the water release will begin in about 2 years and that the process will likely take decades. back in the United States, convicted rapist and former Hollywood movie mogul Harvey Weinstein appeared by video link in a New York court Monday, where a judge is weighing whether to extradite him to California to face new charges of rape and sexual assault on five women. Weinstein's next court hearing is set for April 30th. Actor Will Smith and director Antoine Fuqua are moving production of their upcoming film Emancipation out of Georgia in a protest against voter suppression law signed by Republican Governor Brian Kemp in March. In a joint statement, Smith and Fuqua write, quote, "We cannot in good conscience provide economic support to a government that enacts regressive voting laws that are designed to restrict voter access. The new Georgia voting laws are reminiscent of voting impediments that were passed at the end of Reconstruction to prevent many Americans from voting," unquote. In Emancipation, Will Smith will portray an enslaved man known as Whipped Peter, who escaped a Louisiana plantation and joined the Union Army in 1863. In Georgia, the Southern Center for Human Rights is demanding better treatment and conditions for people incarcerated at the Lee Arundel State Prison, where advocates say people who've just given birth are being shackled or placed in solitary confinement in violation of state and federal law. In a letter to the prison's warden, the group says people have described being placed in solitary within days of giving birth, sometimes without being able to change out of the bloodied clothing they wore during childbirth. The group also warns of using solitary confinement to detain people who've contracted COVID-19, who are often held in filthy cells with malfunctioning plumbing, insufficient water, and personal hygiene products. Fox News is defending primetime host Tucker Carlson over his on-air defense of the white supremacist Great Replacement theory. On April 8th, Carlson made these comments as he lashed out against immigrants and the Democratic Party.
The left and all the little gatekeepers on Twitter become literally hysterical if you use the term replacement, if you suggest that the Democratic Party is trying to replace the current electorate, the voters now casting ballots, with new people, more obedient voters from the third world. But they become hysterical because that's what's happening, actually. Let's just say it. That's true.
Tucker Carlson's reference to replacement echoed the words of violent white supremacists who marched in Charlottesville, Virginia in 2017, chanting, "You will not replace us and Jews will not replace us." The Anti-Defamation League's urging Fox News to fire Carlson, calling his comments anti-Semitic, racist and toxic. Tucker Carlson Tonight was former President Trump's favorite Fox News program and is the most popular cable news show in history. The Washington Post reports domestic terrorism incidents surged to a record high in 2020, fueled by white supremacist, anti-Muslim, and anti-government extremists on the far right. The Post found that since 2015, right-wing extremists have been involved in 267 plots or attacks, leading to 91 deaths. And the National Collegiate Athletic Association, the NCAA, said Monday it firmly and unequivocally supports transgender student athletes in the face of Republican-led efforts to ban trans athletes from school sports. The NCAA has also vowed to hold championships only in places that are free of discrimination. In a statement, it says, quote, "Our clear expectation is that all student athletes will be treated with dignity and respect." Almost 30 state legislatures are considering bills banning trans students from competing in school sports. Four states, Mississippi, Tennessee, Arkansas, and Idaho, have already enacted such bans. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, we begin today's show with a warning. A warning to our audience, this segment contains graphic footage and accounts of police violence. Protests are continuing in the Minneapolis area after a white police officer shot and killed a 20-year-old black man, Dante Wright, during a traffic stop Sunday afternoon in the Minneapolis suburb of Brooklyn Center. The deadly shooting took place about 10 miles from where former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin's on trial for murdering George Floyd. On Monday, police fired tear gas, rubber-coated bullets, stun grenades as protesters defied a curfew and took to the streets, Brooklyn Center, for a second straight night. Police said 40 people were arrested. More than a dozen were also arrested during protests in Minneapolis. Just before he was killed, Dante Wright called his mother to say he was being pulled over, allegedly because an air freshener was obscuring his rearview mirror. On Monday night, Dante's aunt, Nyesha Wright, called into CNN.
My mother shouldn't have to be burying her grandchild. My brother, my sister, they shouldn't have to be burying their son. Not over air freshener. They stopped them over air freshener. Let's get that correct. His tag wasn't expired. My sister and them had just bought him that car. Y'all want to see it? People want to try to look for something bad to go ahead and justify this. How about we just justify this man's life was taken? They took my man's life from him. My great-nephew has to now grow up not even knowing, not even being able to touch his father. You tell me, is it all right to take somebody's life over a misdemeanor warrant just for some weed? You got these politicians out here smoking weed. They ain't dead.
That was Nyesha Wright, the aunt of Dante Wright, speaking to Don Lemon on CNN. State authorities have identified the officer who killed Dante Wright as Kimberly Potter, a 26-year police veteran who served as the police union president for the department. She's been placed on administrative leave. On Monday, the police chief in Brooklyn Center claimed Potter accidentally pulled her gun instead of a taser. The police department also released body cam footage of the shooting. According to the Star Tribune, Dante Wright is the sixth person killed by Brooklyn Center Police since 2012. Five of the six have been men of color. Brooklyn Center Mayor Mike Elliott, who's the town's first black mayor, spoke to reporters Monday.
Our hearts are aching right now. We are in pain right now. And we recognize that this couldn't have happened at a worse time. We recognize that this is happening at a time when our community, when all of America, indeed all of the world, is watching our community, that we are all collectively devastated, and we have been for over a year now by the killing of George Floyd, and that we continue to be distressed as we go through the Derek Chauvin trial. So having a police-involved shooting happen in our community and killing a young man is heartbreaking and just unfathomable.
On Monday night, the Brooklyn Center City Council voted to give command authority of the police to the mayor you just heard, stripping the power from the city manager. Soon after the vote, the mayor announced that the Brooklyn Center city manager had been fired. Earlier in the day, the city manager refused to name the officer who shot Dante Wright. He was questioned by civil rights attorney Nakima Levy Armstrong.
So can you instruct the chief to release her name?
I won't do that at this moment, at this place.
Why?
It would be inappropriate.
That's not inappropriate. What was inappropriate was killing Dante Wright under those circumstances. So you are working harder to protect a killer cop than a victim of police murder.
That was Nakima Levy Armstrong questioning Brooklyn Center City Manager Kurt Bagani just before he was fired. Nakima joins us now from Minneapolis, a civil rights attorney, activist, and executive director of Wayfinder Foundation. She previously served as president of the Minneapolis NAACP. We're also joined by Jelani Hussein, executive director of the Minnesota chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations. And we welcome you both to Democracy Now! So, Nakima Levy Armstrong, let's continue where you were questioning the man who was just fired, a city manager who was in charge of the police, and now the police have been put under the mayor. Can you talk about what took place on Sunday, and also why you felt it was so critical to lay these facts out.
Thank you, Amy. From our understanding, Dante Wright was driving in his car, minding his own business. It was a new car, and he was pulled over, according to his mom, for having an air freshener hanging on his mirror. His mom was on the phone with him during that traffic stop, and she heard him asking the police, "Why are you pulling me over?" And then she heard them ordering him out of the car. And the next thing you know, the phone disconnects. A few minutes later, she gets a call back from the girlfriend who was in the car with him, letting her know that Dante had been shot. And in the aftermath of all of that, we went to the site where Dante was killed. His body lay in the streets for 5 hours. Waiting for the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, apparently, to come and pick up his body. That agitated the crowd. Tensions were high. After Dante's body was removed, we went to the Brooklyn Center Police Department, where over 100 young people were outside demonstrating. And one of the most shocking aspects of the situation was that the police chief and the city manager ordered that the lights be turned off all around the police station, putting us in significant danger.
Nakima Levy Armstrong, I want to go back to this issue of why Dante was stopped. So much of policing over the past 20 years in America has been based on this theory of the broken windows theory. You stop and detain a quote suspect for a minor issue, and then in the hope of being able to discover some bigger criminal activity. And this has been at the heart of so many of these stops. I'm wondering, from what you can tell, has this been a reigning policy in the Minneapolis area as well? And has there been any attempt by city or police officials to change that policy?
Unfortunately, there has not been a serious attempt to change the phenomenon of driving while Black, which is something that happens to Black people on a routine basis in the Twin Cities and across the state of Minnesota. Several years ago, African-American residents and activists pushed for a bill that would end racial profiling, but legislators at that time did not follow through on their promises to address the issue. And so Black people in the Twin Cities and across the state of Minnesota are pulled over at significantly greater rates than our white counterparts. And it has sometimes led to the kinds of fatality that we saw with Dante Wright, Philando Castile, and many others.
And what do you know in terms of the history of this particular police officer, Kim Potter? She was identified as having been a union president, police union president in the past, but also was identified as playing a role in advising an officer in a previous killing, some of the 2019 killing of Kobe Dimmick Heisler.
Yes. So let me be clear about the fact that with this woman, Kim Potter, being a 26-year veteran, there is absolutely no plausible way that she mistook a gun for a taser or her taser for a gun. It's just unfathomable that she would even make that excuse. In terms of a previous killing of a young Black man named Kobe Heisler, who had autism, Kim Potter was involved in advising the officers to take separate cars and other acts that they could take in order to try to cover up what happened to Kobe Heisler. His family has been in mourning since his life was taken, and he joins several other people of color who have been killed by the Brooklyn Center Police Department.
I wanted to bring Jelani Hussein into the conversation, executive director of the Minneapolis chapter of Council on American Islamic Relations. Jelani, you've been out on the street from the beginning of the protest. You were trying to get the police to calm down. This is afterwards and how they dealt with the protesters. Can you lay out what you understood? And also, seeing that horrific videotape, it was other officers who stopped Dante and his girlfriend. as he's talking to his mother on the phone. And he's got air freshener, a little air freshener piece hanging from the rearview mirror. But when you see that videotape, she doesn't just draw the gun and shoot. You see it for a few seconds as she's saying, taser, taser. Isn't there even a different color handle on the taser? Wouldn't someone say, that is your gun? But let alone why any of this had come to drawing guns on a young man who had some air freshener hanging from the mirror.
No, absolutely, absolutely. Thank you for having me. And again, all of us right now sending our condolences to this family. And as I said yesterday, we don't know what to say to families anymore. And sadly, but also I think the unfortunate reality is that as everybody's watching the Chauvin trial right now, people have this idea somewhat that something has fundamentally changed to actually hold police accountable. And for this to happen right now is a testament that American policing is as dangerous as they are. And as you mentioned, this video, first of all, you know, police officers are trained to pull the taser from the opposite side. And you're right. The taser has a completely different feel. It's much lighter. And this officer who's been there for 26 years should know better. But you're right. As I said yesterday and will continue to say, this officer did not believe in the humanity of Dante Wright. And for her to immediately pull anything for a young man who was cooperating, a young man who followed instruction, a young man who showed no visibility of threat, to be shot in that manner is absolutely the reality of policing in America. They are deadly. They kill black and brown people. And this is exactly what has been happening. And this is why America really needs to wake up. And policies have to be put in place to hold these killer cops accountable. And I think many people are trying to dig themselves in the sand right now, thinking that, oh, no, this did not happen. It did happen. A young man was killed while we're watching the Derek Chauvin trial. And to be honest with you, Amy, it is just gut-wrenching. And then, as you said, the evening, peaceful protesters standing outside the police station. Not a single person. I was one of the few people there early. Not a single person was even on the sidewalk of the police department until nearly 50 officers came with riot gear. And many of them had been planning for this because of the Chauvin trial. This was already plans that they had. They came out, started to agitate protesters. And God forbid there was a major accident, because they were literally firing flashbangs and other types of projectiles at apartment building where children were in their home, literally no regards for children, no regards for the families that even lived across the police department, a dangerous scene. And we were on the call with the mayor, who unfortunately in this city did not have authority. The city manager and the police chief did, and they refused to even talk to us. I remember talking to one of the officers on the scene. I said, who was in command? They told us it was the police chief. I said, we need to talk to him. And they said, he is busy planning, meaning he is busy terrorizing our community. And it is exactly what happened. So it is just an unfortunate time right now for all of us. But the unbelievable thing that happened in Brooklyn Center is exactly the reality that's happened. And this will continue to happen, sadly, until something fundamentally changes.
And Jelani, I wanted to ask you about that. You mentioned you were on the phone with the mayor. Could you talk about this whole issue of this unelected city manager actually being in charge of the police? Many small towns and cities across the country use this system of city managers, but they are really accountable to no one, unlike the mayor or the city council. What was your sense of what happened there?
Yeah, Mike, the mayor, Mike Elliott, that night was responsive to all of us. He got us on the phone. We talked to him about on the scene to remove the police officers initially where they had killed Dante Wright. And he was working that entire night in communication with us and community leaders. And as you said, the charter of the city of Brooklyn Center has given full authority of this city manager to direct and lead the police department. And when the mayor, my understanding, called the city manager and told him of the demands that the community was making, he ignored it. He has ignored everything. He's been there for 20 plus years. And so yesterday, as you saw, we demanded for the firing of the city manager, the police chief, and the officer, and just the process that the police department has created, the policies that it's created to shield itself from any type of accountability was displayed, that they could not even fire the police chief until they fire, first of all, the city manager, until they change the charter amendment or at least change the an ordinance to be able to have control of the police department. And so this is the reality. And this city, the mayor really couldn't do anything, even though he was trying to plead to de-escalate the situation while the police was escalating.
And the governor, Walz, went right from talking about this to, he said he was going to, the Minnesota legislature demanding that legislation that was introduced after George Floyd was killed be passed. Jelani Hussein, can you talk about why that has not happened yet?
Well, I mean, for folks who are not aware, I know Minnesota is a little bit of a flyover state, but this is one of the racist states in the union. It is racist because for the longest time, no policies around police accountability or any other really serious issues have been raised, but nothing has been done. Minnesota has one of the worst disparities in economics, in education for people of color. It has continuously has been that and has gotten worse. And politicians, including Democrats, have claimed that they're addressing these issues. But when policies are presented to them, they have done nothing. We have been proposing nearly 8 bills since this summer, and we have been faced with opposition. We have been faced with absolutely no action. And it's been actually the Democrats. We haven't even had a chance to even fight with Republicans when Democrats have not failed. And the same Democrat leaders who were telling us that they care about these issues, who did not do anything last night, were talking about now it's the time to pass police accountability, where we were already in the middle of a reckoning with the killing of George Floyd and now the trial of Derek Chauvin and those officers. So I hope that maybe more people can wake up and see the reality that Minnesota, the state that killed George Floyd, has done nothing, while other states are trying to at least attempt to pass some legislation. So I think people need to wake up and realize that this has never been a problem just in the Republicans who really stand with the police, but also Democrats who have failed to hold up their end of the bargain.
Jelani Hussein, I want to thank you for being with us, Executive Director of Minneapolis Chapter of Council on American Islamic Relations. When we come back, we're going to talk about the Chauvin trial. Nakeem Alivi Armstrong, we'd like you to stay on with us, civil rights attorney, activist, Executive Director of the Wayfinder Foundation, former president of Minnesota NAACP, and we'll also be speaking with a former national president of the NAACP, Ben Jealous. As we look at the case of Derek Chauvin, but also who will be next to head the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice, which bears on all of this. Stay with us.
The dark brown shades of my skin, only add color to my tears. That splash against my hollow bones, that rocks my soul. Looking back over my false dreams that I once knew, wondering why my dreams never came true. Is it because I'm black? Somebody tell me, what can I do? Oh, Lord. Oh, something is holding me back. Is it because I'm black? Yeah. In this world of
Because I'm Black by Syl Johnson. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we continue to talk about what's happening in Minnesota. Now to the trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin on trial for murdering George Floyd. The trial's taking place 10 miles from where a white police officer killed Dante Wright, a 20-year-old Black man, Sunday. On Monday, a cardiologist called as an expert witness in the Chauvin trial by the prosecution testified George Floyd died due to oxygen deprivation after Chauvin kneeled on his neck for over 9 minutes. George Floyd's brother, Philonis, also testified and talked about how close George was to his mother, who died in 2018.
And when we went to the funeral, it's just George just sat there at the casket over and over again. He would just say, "Mama, Mama," over and over again. And I didn't know what to tell him because I was in pain too. We all were hurting. And he was just kissing her and just kissing her. He didn't want to leave the casket. And everybody was like, "Come on, come on, it's going to be okay." But it was just difficult because I don't know who can take that when you watch your mother, somebody who loved and cherished you and nourished you for your entire life, and then they have to leave you. We all have to go through it, but it's difficult. And George, he was just in pain the entire time.
Sir, you indicated your mother passed away May 30. That was 2018. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
Is that a picture of your mother and George when he was younger?
Yes, sir.
I'm going to offer Exhibit 284.
Objection. 284 is received.
Permission to publish. Sir, would you please describe this photo and what you know about it?
That's my mother. She's no longer with us right now, but that's my oldest brother, George. I miss both of them. I was married. In May 24th, I got married. And my brother was killed May 25th. And my mom died on May 30th. It's like a bittersweet month because I'm supposed to be happy when that month comes.
George Floyd's brother Philonis testifying Monday. Derek Chauvin's defense is due to call its first witnesses today to talk more about the trial of Derek Chauvin. We're staying with Nakeem Alevi Armstrong, the Minneapolis-based civil rights attorney, activist, executive director of Wayfinder Foundation, former president of the Minneapolis NAACP. Can you talk about the wrapping up of the prosecution? Once again, one officer after another, the leaders in the Minneapolis Police Department, and then experts saying that it was not a heart attack, it was not drugs, it was the cutting off of the oxygen supply by Chauvin's knee, the significance of this, and also the significance of the defense asking to sequester the jury, given what happened with the murder of another African-American man down the road. But, of course, the judge said no.
Well, prosecutors finished their case as strongly as they started, in terms of humanizing George Floyd, putting on extremely emotional testimony from the bystanders early on, as well as from George Floyd's brother, who provided what's called spark of life testimony in the state of Minnesota. One of the things that I think is important as a result of the testimony of George Floyd's brother is the fact that his testimony paints a picture for the jury of what George Floyd's life meant to the family and to the community and how his death has impacted them. I also think that the state did a really good job of providing expert witness testimony in the form of medical evidence, as well as use of force testimony, and also helping to break what some may call that blue wall of silence by having so many police officers testify in the prosecution's case against George Floyd. We know that through one trial, that blue wall of silence is not going to crumble, but it is a start. And Chief Arredondo has been able to set the tone for the department in terms of his expectations and sending a signal to officers that they will not be allowed to get away with this kind of behavior. Now, on the flip side, there are folks who feel that the only reason that these officers have testified is because the world is watching. And I believe that there is a lot of truth to that, because some of the underlying issues within the Minneapolis Police Department, as far as the culture, have not yet changed. Now, in terms of yesterday's motion hearings, we heard from defense counsel Eric Nelson that the unrest that happened on Sunday night would have an impact on the jury. So he was recommending that the jury be sequestered. Judge Cahill made the best decision in refusing to sequester the jury and articulating that these are two separate incidences. What happened in Brooklyn Center as a result of the killing of Dante Wright at the hands of the police is not the same as what is happening in the trial of Derek Chauvin and the killing of George Floyd.
And Nakima, I wanted to ask you, in terms of the decision by Governor Tim Walz to issue a curfew for several counties in the Twin Cities area from 7 p.m. until 6 a.m. Tuesday, and given the fact that we're dealing with this is the beginning of Ramadan, your thoughts about these restrictions?
I think that the restrictions are ridiculous from my perspective. As someone who has been out on the front lines, I've been out both nights along with Jelani Hussein and many other activists and organizers. It is really upsetting that the governor would issue a curfew rather than working proactively to curb police violence and set the tone by using his bully pulpit, pushing for policy changes, and really advocating for the rights of Black people and other people of color who've been abused by police. Instead, what we're seeing is the governor push for more funding for law enforcement, bring in the National Guard, help to set up barricades and chain link fencing around the courthouse and other buildings throughout the Twin Cities. And now this additional curfew. Many young people last night intentionally violated the curfew because they're sending a signal that they are fed up with police violence in the state of Minnesota and not feeling safe as young Black people out in the community.
Nakima Levy-Armstrong, I want to thank you for being with us, Minneapolis-based civil rights attorney, activist, executive director of the Wayfinder Foundation. When we come back, we'll be joined by the former head of the National NAACP, now president of People for the American Way. We'll be joined by Ben Jealous to talk about not only the Chauvin trial, but also the right-wing smear campaign targeting Kristen Clark, President Biden's nominee to head the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice. Her hearing begins Wednesday. Stay with us.
When I get older, losing my head, many years from now, will you still be sending me a Valentine? Birthday greetings, bottle of wine. If I've been out till 2:45, would you lock the door? Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
When I'm 64 by the Beatles. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Juan Gonzalez with Amy Goodman. And Amy, today we want to wish you a very happy 64th birthday. It seems only yesterday you were a young rebel reporter. Well, now you're a mature rebel reporter.
Well, thank you, Juan. And it's wonderful to spend this day with you, or at least this hour, with our listeners, our viewers and readers, but such difficult times that we have to deal with. No better group of people to deal with these critical issues. So thanks so much. Yes, this is Democracy Now! It's the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. And we're continuing to talk about what's happening in Minnesota and around the this country amid ongoing police abuse, hate crimes, and increasing attacks on voting rights. We look now at President Biden's nomination of Kristen Clark, head of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, to become the first Black woman to lead the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division, what the former Attorney General Eric Holder called the agency's crown jewel. Clark is set to appear Wednesday before the Senate Judiciary Committee for her confirmation hearing amidst an onslaught of attacks from Republicans. So far this year, the far-right Fox News host Tucker Carlson has devoted at least five segments to attacking Clark's nomination. Last month, he interviewed Maureen Faulkner, widow of the Philadelphia police officer Mumia Abu-Jamal, widow of the police officer who Mumia Abu-Jamal was convicted of killing, Daniel Faulkner. Faulkner accused Clark of working to free Mumia, even though Clark worked on voting rights while she was with the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, not Mumia Abu-Jamal's case. Support for Mumia Abu-Jamal was also used in 2014 to attack the nomination of another Black civil rights attorney, Debo Adebigle, to the same DOJ position. He actually worked on the case, unlike Clark, though that is hardly disqualifying. This is Faulkner attacking Clark on Fox.
She hates white people. That's my honest to God truth feeling. And she wants to defund the police. She's a vile woman, and she's dangerous. I know she has said things about the Jewish people, and now she seems to be backpedaling on all this, now that she's being called out on it.
In fact, Kristen Clark is a longtime champion of voting rights, a defender against hate and violent extremism, a supporter of equality for all. This is video released by the People for the American Way in support of Clark.
My name is Susan Cartel, and I've worked for 26 years at Con Edison in New York. You know, this was the good old boys club. They would make commentaries about your chest or you know, your behind. When we met Kristen Clark, we found somebody that believed in us. She gave us our life back. She said to Con Ed, "You will treat everybody equal." Kristen really did make our fight her fight. Now we need to make her fight our fight. Go to herfightourfight.org and tell your senators, support Kristen Clark.
Kristen Clark's confirmation hearing comes as another civil rights lawyer, Vinita Gupta, awaits a Senate vote on her nomination to become the Justice Department's Assistant Attorney General. For more, we go to Ben Jealous, president of People for the American Way, former president of the NAACP. Ben, welcome back to Democracy Now!, also former gubernatorial candidate in Maryland. Ben, if you can comment on this right-wing smear attack on Kristen Clark.
Sure. I mean, first of all, happy birthday, Amy.
Thanks.
The irony of hearing a guest on Tucker Carlson's show accuse anybody of being anti-Semitic, let alone racist against a group of people, just kind of sits with me. I mean, it was earlier this week that the Anti-Defamation League called for him to be fired because of his anti-Semitism. And the civil rights community has long been concerned about his racism. But that's what the right wing will do. You know, there has never been a woman of color to lead the United States Department of Justice Civil Rights Division. There have only been two Black men to ever lead it. And whenever one comes up, they make sport, quite frankly, of trying to destroy their character, trying to, you know, defame their character, destroy their reputation. And they see women of color as being very vulnerable, which is why we launched the Her Fight, Our Fight campaign. Biden has distinguished himself by appointing a number of women of color. He's expected to appoint a Black woman to the Supreme Court for the first time. And we can already see the right-wing attack machine kind of getting out the sharp knives to go after each of these nominees.
And Ben, could you talk about why you think that Kristen Clark is the best person for the job right now? What in terms of her track record?
I mean, yeah, she's incredible. She's represented the League of Women Voters for years on a number of voting rights cases. She's been down in the trenches on gender discrimination, on race discrimination, making sure that you know, as Ms. Cartel said, everyone is treated equal. And when you meet her, she just kind of lights up a room with her commitment to really ensuring that the Constitution has meaning for all the people of this country. That's exactly who you want leading the Civil Rights Division. The trouble, of course, is that the Republican Party is in the midst of a massive assault on voting rights and, frankly, defending the right of cops to kill black people with impunity. And the last thing they want in this moment is a fully staffed United States Department of Justice Civil Rights Division led by a civil rights lawyer, led by a voting rights lawyer. That's their nightmare right now. And so they're trying to pretend that she is something that she's not. She's just an incredible fighter for the justice and equality of all of us.
And what about the situation with Vanita Gupta, the Judiciary Committee, basically deadlocked on along partisan lines on her nomination? What is your sense of how women of color are being dealt with, even in the Biden administration right now by the by Senate Republicans?
Well, the good news is that the Senate Democrats intend to get Gupta out of committee and a vote on the floor, and they have the votes. So we're confident about that. With regards to the Republicans, all you got to do is go back and roll the tape on how Ted Cruz went after Ms. Gupta. It was vile. It was an embarrassment to the U.S. Senate. It was full of lies and venom. And it really speaks to how fearful a party that has become characterized by its cowards, by people like Kemp in Georgia, people like Donald Trump, who would rather suppress votes than actually compete for voters. Just the lows they will go to keep the U.S. Department of Justice from functioning while they go about their work of seeking to suppress voters, while they go about their work of preserving the right of the worst officers to kill black people with impunity.
Ben, if you can talk about the climate we are in right now, as we talk about the killing of Dante Wright, this young 20-year-old, the father of an infant, driving with his girlfriend on a Sunday afternoon to a car wash at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and he is killed by a white police officer in Brooklyn Center. We've got the Derek Chauvin trial. Now the defense begins. And we're talking to you. You're from Maryland, which just enacted major police reform Saturday, becoming the first state to repeal the Police Bill of Rights and establish new standards for use of force and how police are investigated and disciplined. The majority Democratic lawmakers overrode the vetoes by Republican Governor Larry Hogan to pass the new measures, which also require officers to use body cams, restrict no-knock warrants, allow for public involvement in matters of police discipline and misconduct. You ran against Larry Hogan. Can you talk about whether you see these kind of developments as enough? You also talk about changes in police departments like we see in Ithaca, New York, and yet the pace of police murders of unarmed African-American men.
You know, we're seeking to destroy, to end a system that's reigned in our country for hundreds of years in which black people can be killed with impunity by the cops. In the state of Minnesota, what we know is that there's an authoritarianism that runs through law enforcement there, as well as racism. But in between Philando Castile and George Floyd, it was Justine Damon who was killed, a white woman, by a black officer. She was having a seizure, as I recall. And similar to what we saw this case with the young 20-year-old in Brooklyn Park, she was not complying because she was having a seizure. She was shot and killed. In this case, he was not complying. He was shot and killed. And they said, well, you know, they were just going to taser a person who's behind the wheel of a car. We have got to get to a place in this country where, what's also important about that case is that he called his mom afraid. Even though he was with his girlfriend, he still called his mother afraid of what they may do to him. His father was out grocery shopping. This is every black parent's nightmare. And while it sounds like it's possible that he didn't make the best decisions in that moment. There are plenty of young white people who don't make the best decisions when dealing with officers who don't end up dead. And that's what we really have to get to. Now, what's exciting about what we've seen in upstate New York, in Ithaca, is that they've taken a step back and said, we need to put the police under direct civilian control, have a civilian-led public safety department. And we need to take those half of the that half of the work that really is social work, that's, you know, dealing with drunks, that's dealing with homeless people, and let unarmed social workers respond to them. So through attrition, they're going to replace, as officers quit over time, up to half of them with unarmed uniformed social workers. That's the type of thinking that we need to have. We need to have thinking about, in this moment, with a society as diverse as ours, where we're deeply committed to people's equality, where we want everybody to be safe, how do we build public safety departments that represent who we are today, rather than, you know, maintain a culture that takes you right back to the worst eras in our history?
Ben, I want to ask you, there are on some of the conservative right wing talk shows, you're seeing increasing reporting on the rise in crime and violence that is occurring across the country. And I'm wondering if you and as if to say, see what is happening as a result of criticism and more accountability on the police, crime is rising. I'm wondering your response to this line, because I remember back when I was a young reporter in the 80s and 90s, I never forget the night of the Crown Heights riot in Brooklyn, and I was standing next to several policemen who were standing by doing nothing while there was increasing violence in the street. And I heard one cop say to the other, this was during the Dinkins era, of Mayor Dinkins' era, now the city will see what Dinkins' people are going to be doing, as if to say, let them riot. And I'm wondering to what degree you get a sense that some police departments around the country are, in essence, standing down and allowing violence and crime to escalate as a way of showing the society how much they are needed.
So let's deal with both issues there separately. You know, if you go back to Commissioner Kelly, who kind of came to fame, as I recall, during the Dinkins administration, then I think he was a chief. Just on the issue of crime rising and falling, he said, you know, taking credit for that is like taking credit for the moon or the sun, you know, rising or setting. That's under normal times and normal circumstances. Then you have what appears to be going on now, where you hear just so, like, such a preponderance of anecdotes of black parents calling the department and being told, oh, the kids you're worried about are black. Oh, we can't respond because we're worried about how we'll be responded to. You know, of officers, unions having conversations about what will happen, you know, positive for the union. If they sit back, if they stay in the station house, if they don't respond. And I hope somewhere there's a lawyer considering bringing a civil RICO case against these FOPs. I mean, the FOP in Minneapolis, let's not forget that the Minnesota AFL-CIO issued a press statement calling that FOP in Minneapolis a white supremacist organization. We have unions that represent police officers that have gone way beyond the bounds of anything that they should be involved in, are involved in our. It appears.
We have 5 seconds.
Suggesting that officers not protect the people that they've sworn to protect in order to strengthen the union's position in politics. And if that's actually true, it's outrageous.
We have to leave it there. Ben Jealous, President of People for the American Way, former president of NAACP, thanks so much for joining us, and a very happy birthday to Joe Parker. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.